One, two, three, four.
Welcome to the first episode of the Behind the Curtain Ministry podcast, brought to you by atacrossroads.net. The purpose of this podcast is to give listeners a behind-the-scenes look at what it's like to be in ministry leadership, specifically the part of ministry leadership that deals with the emotional burden of being in ministry leadership, the psychological burden, the spiritual burden. Often, you will look at your ministry leaders and just think everything's okay, or you think you see whatever they do on a Sunday or whatever they do on the stage, whatever they publish, and you see those things and kind of base them off of those things, not realizing what's actually going on behind the scenes, underneath the surface. So what we want to do with this podcast is show you, the listener, how you can better love your ministry leaders, how you can better support them, how you can better pray for them. But also in this podcast, I hope it's a place that ministry leaders themselves can begin to diagnose some of these things in their lives. Often we as ministry leaders, we get so busy doing and doing and doing ministry, and these things just begin to creep up on us, these burdens, these feelings of being overwhelmed. And so I hope that this is a place leaders themselves can get some resources just to get healthy in these areas before it's too late. This podcast is going to be posted once or twice a month, so please subscribe on iTunes and it'll just auto-update when a new episode is available. I'll also be posting the episodes on atacrossroads.net. That's A-T-A, crossroads.net. The primary content of each episode, will be an interview with a ministry leader. Sometimes this will be a pastor, other times it'll be a musician, an athlete, an author, maybe someone who runs a nonprofit. If you don't know me personally, my name is Noah Filipiak. I'm 9 years into pastoring the church that I planted in Lansing, Michigan. It's called Crossroads Church, and atacrossroads.net is my personal blog. Today's interview for this first episode is going to be with Ken Weitzma. You can tell when you hear Ken's bio, he's an entrepreneur at heart. He planted Antioch Church in Bend, Oregon about 8.5 years ago and is still pastoring there. Started Kilns College 7 years ago, and he also founded the Justice Conference, which is in its 5th year. And this year's Justice Conference is coming up June 5th and 6th. And I encourage you to check it out. I encourage you to go, either go live in Chicago or go to one of the many simulcast locations that they have around the country. This is a really incredible conference. I had the chance to go myself to the Philadelphia conference a couple years ago, and it's just a much-needed conference for the kingdom of God. I'll put it that way, and we'll talk more about it in the interview. But this year's speakers include Dr. Cornell West, Louis Giglio, Eugene Cho, Bob Goff, Lynn Hybels, and many more. I will be there as well, just in attendance, though, not on the speaker list, but would love and really encourage you to check it out. The website is thejusticeconference.com, thejusticeconference.com. Ken is also the author of Pursuing Justice by Thomas Nelson, 2013, as well as his most recent book, The Grand Paradox, also by Thomas Nelson in 2015, which we'll talk about a bit in the interview. So with that, we'll bring in Ken here on the phone. Well, hey, Ken, welcome, and thanks so much for being my first guest ever on the Behind the Curtain Ministry podcast. You're a part of history today, so I hope you're honored by that.
Thank you, man.
Hey, you got it, man. The reason I'm doing this podcast, this is obviously my first episode, and so there's a lot of good podcasts out there, but for me as a church planter, and I know for you as a church planter as well, you've probably experienced this, behind the scenes of ministry often looks a lot different than what the average churchgoer sees on a Sunday. And so what I want to do with this podcast is try to show the listeners just what it's like to be in ministry leadership. I want to try to unveil the curtain a bit to see sort of some of our struggles, to see that we really are human, and to try to help people better pray for their ministry leaders and support
their ministry leaders. So first off, I just want to say thanks for being willing to be vulnerable and kind of let us pull back the curtain on what it's like to be Ken Weitzma.
Absolutely, man. Look forward to it.
Cool. Well, hey, so my first question has to do with your newest book, The Grand Paradox. It just came out in February with Thomas Nelson Publishers. And I'm wondering, since I'm talking about what it's like to be a pastor, how would you describe being a pastor in and of itself as a paradox?
Yeah, I think the whole idea of the book is trying to cash out the kingdom life really feels upside down and counterintuitive. So you give your life away to find it. You love others to find love. You know, the weak will be strong, the first will be last, kind of all those things that just seem like a reverse or a flip from the way the world works. And I think being in ministry is interesting. It's slow. It's trying to put at the center the things that are spiritual or most meaningful. And so it's just a different thing than being in the business world. So I'm in the business world in different areas of my life. Most of my friends are in the business world, but being a pastor is really about being a shepherd. It's really about soul care. It's really about nurture, provision, protection for people, and trying to help make sure there's a healthy Christian community where people can flourish, find safety, being, you know, encourage one another, and that in the midst of that, they're going to come to know God that much more. So it's just a totally different mission.
So how do you personally fight against what I would call self-glory in ministry? Because I think that's where some of the paradox comes in. People see pastors, especially now that you're an author of two books, speaking, you know, at the Justice Conference and other places, people see that and often are judgmental, you know. Thinking, and there's certainly some pastors out there, right, who we would probably say that about. So for you, how do you fight against that?
Well, it's two things. One is just the obvious, which is anything prominent that sticks out that is visible. And if it's visible, people are going to have opinions on it. So leadership by its very nature means that as you kind of move along in leadership, you're going to stick out, you're going to be visible, you're going to be exposed. And when you're exposed, again, people are going to like it, people are going to not like it. And so that's just a part of leadership. The second part, though, whether a person who gains kind of leadership in the Christian world out there is doing it from the right motivation or the wrong one, I go back to a story that was told of Ruth Bell Graham and Billy Graham being at the White House one time, and someone leaned across her and said, "How do you keep Billy Graham, you know, how do you keep your husband humble?"
Yeah.
He meets with these world leaders, he meets with kings, he meets with presidents. How do you keep him humble? And Ruth Bell Graham kind of looked at this person and said, "It's not my job to keep Billy humble. It's my job to love him. It's the Holy Spirit's job to keep him humble." Mm-hmm. And I think the biggest thing, and it's hard for other people to really see, but I think the biggest thing that keeps a pastor in the pocket where they're supposed to be is their personal relationship with God. If you're living in solitude and prayer on a regular basis, and that relationship is close and intimate, I really truly believe that the Holy Spirit does a really great job of keeping you humble and knocking you down when you need to be knocked down, or pointing out your flaws or the mistakes or the people that you're messing up in the process of trying to fix people. And
right.
that, and seeing all that, it kind of keeps it healthy. Now, there's plenty of leaders that carry the name or would talk as if they have that kind of relationship with God. And, you know, it's not my job to judge anybody, but I think the ones that don't, that are taking that a little too lightly, or they're really speaking about 10, 20 years ago when they were walking close with the Lord, those are the ones that I think become a little bit unhinged. They're not anchored into the rock, so to speak. They don't see themselves as being underneath a chief shepherd, and so their leadership isn't submitted, and their leadership becomes a little bit too autocratic, too dictatorial, and it can be a bad thing. So I think leadership in itself, prominence in itself, isn't a bad thing. It's like power or money or sex. They're neutral things that can be used for good or bad. I think the real indicator here is someone's personal walk with the Lord.
That's really helpful. You mentioned solitude and prayer, and I know for me, I mean, I've been a Christian most of my life and I've been a pastor for like 10 years now, and I'm just now learning about solitude and prayer. I just read a really good book by Ruth Haley Barton called Strengthening the Soul of Your Leadership, and it's kind of turned my whole world upside down, like learning the essentials of solitude and prayer. And
sure.
Maybe could you share with me and with us how you got introduced to this discipline of solitude and prayer? I'm just really glad you mentioned that. And then maybe what are some specific things that maybe that the Lord has shown you in solitude and prayer, or maybe some things you would never have learned had you not taken that sure. solitude time specifically?
Yeah, I actually tell this whole story in The Grand Paradox. And I think when we really understand faith, it's this weird tension of leveraging ourselves every day to walk forward in trust and obedience, even when our eyes or the world or our advisors would tell us there's a better way, there's an easier way, there's a more fun way. And yet we kind of continue to lean into this awkward tension, this blind walk of faith and obedience. And in doing that, the question really becomes, how do I know that I'm walking the right road? How do I know that I'm actually following God? How do I know that all this kind of pain and suffering or the tension that I'm existing in is really God's will for me? And so prayer becomes a really huge thing when you're trying to walk by faith. And I think it shows us right away that our typical way of praying in America is very deficient. Our typical way of praying is, whether in group or by ourselves, is really just about writing out a list and kind of throwing it up to God, lobbing to Him that we're sick or we need help on a test or Aunt Mildred's big toe needs to be fixed.
Right,
or,
right.
You know, whatever it is. And we kind of give that list and then wait to see if God's going to answer it. And we don't really believe that He's going to, because, you know, we present lists all the time and it doesn't seem like most of them get answered. So there's really a weird transactional way that we come to God. And I think completely foreign to seeing scripture with Jesus staying up through the hours of the night in solitude, or Paul talking about praying without ceasing, or talking about fellowship with the Spirit. In other words, a dynamic relationship. And I think God already knows what problems I have, what I'm going to request that way. I don't think that He needs me to give Him information so much as I need to get information from Him.
Yeah, right.
And so when we really understand what we need from prayer, which is to hear from God, that's the beginning. And that happened for me back in the late 90s when I was in grad school down in Southern California, and found Henry Nouwen and a bunch of other authors and started trying to pursue, what does it mean for me to hear God? What does it mean for me to listen to God? And I would drive to the Huntington Library. If anyone is familiar with the Pasadena area and the Huntington Library, beautiful gardens and everything. And I would just, at first, an hour, then 2 hours, then 3 hours, then 4 hours, you know, then whole days. And it's awkward. I mean, the first time you try and still yourself, all the anxiety comes up. And you have to slowly learn that habit of, you know, continuing to sit there until all of that anxiety kind of burns itself out. And then you're left in this very still place where I think the Lord can slowly begin to show you things or bring things to the surface. Now, that to me is true prayer, and I use the word solitude for it, but it's really getting to that place where we can hear from God.
That's awesome, man. Yeah. And I have found as a pastor, and I'm sure you have as well, there's that incredible amount of noise in ministry. And, you know, one thing you mentioned about leadership and being prominent, sometimes people are going to like it and sometimes they're not going to like it. And that's a lot of noise as well, whether you're a pastor or an author or whatever it might be. I'm wondering if you can talk about that a little bit, specifically advice you'd give to pastors. As pastors, we're going to let people down, yet often,
sure.
especially as church planters, it feels like that's like the worst sin we can commit, is letting somebody down. Because especially when you're first starting out, I mean, you need every like warm body you can get in your church because you were starting out with this really small group of people. So talk about give us advice on letting people down. And then maybe to churchgoers, give churchgoers advice on them being let down by their pastors, because they tend to freak out sometimes.
Sure. I think the biggest thing, and this is maybe the hardest thing if somebody's in leadership, but the commitment has to be there from the beginning that you're not going to use your people. And I think immediately church growth and numbers and stuff like that goes out the door. But the commitment has to be there that the shepherd exists for the sheep, not the other way around. Because if you're trying to build an empire or a platform, you're going to use people, you're going to manipulate people, yeah. You're going to hurt people. Now, it's obviously messy, and so even with the right motives, you're going to still hurt people. I think the biggest thing then is transparency. If your heart's in the right place, you just need to be honest with your failings. So I on a regular basis, apologize. Hey, we started this church to try and reach people who had been victims of spiritual abuse. And I hate the fact that some people probably have left this church feeling like it wasn't the right thing. You know, what I rejoice in is that that's a small number, and at any point I'm willing to try to make amends or fix or speak into that. But yeah, it pains me that while we're trying to help people, sometimes we hurt people. So to say that from the pulpit, to be honest with it, to be transparent with your flaws, your weaknesses, and especially with your closest circle of staff or friends, so that they can be kind of your tight support group. I think you can withstand any kind of criticism or mistake if the people closest to you see your heart, know that you're willing to be honest with them, that you truly are humble. They'll get your back. They'll be loyal. And then you can work through any problems that come up.
And what about for people in the church, your average churchgoer, their pastor lets them down? What should they hear from this episode?
I think it happens a lot, right? So the first thing is I think we need to be more discriminate when we pick a church. So the first thing is you're picking a family, and some families are healthy and some families are dysfunctional. We know that, right? I mean, some families laugh together at Thanksgiving. Some families fight at Thanksgiving. So if you're choosing a church, rather than the style of the worship or the light show, look for a healthy church. Is there a healthy leadership? Is there a high turnover rate, or do people stick around and raise their kids in this community? So I think the first thing is choose wisely, because you're choosing a family. And then the second thing is you chose a family. So if you do get wounded, you have to be willing to say that happens in families, happens, you know, in our natural families, it happens in our spiritual families. And so you have to, instead of feeling like the victim, you might be the victim, but instead of feeling like it all the time or playing into that role, try to reconcile as best as possible, be transparent, pursue people, and try to fix those things. If you can redeem those broken situations, then you're helping the church become its best self. And so what I would first say to people is, I know it hurts. I know you've been wounded. Try to deal with it in a biblical way, and you might have saved your brother or saved the church. Now, if you really have been abused, I think that's just a sad thing. And then I counsel those people, please don't give up on church because of that experience. So don't, you know, leaving the church altogether certainly gets you away from the possibility of being hurt again, but it also cuts you off from the body. And so what I would say with those people is find somewhere where you can heal, find a pastor who's willing to kind of carry your burdens, and where you can begin to build trust again, that when God created this thing called the local church, he knew what he was doing, even though it was messy.
Yeah, man. Yeah. So in the Grand Paradox, you have this really good section in there I really liked about spiritual fatigue. I thought it was really helpful for some things I've wrestled with. I'm wondering for you personally, I mean, you do a ton of stuff. You know, you're a pastor, you started a college, you founded the Justice Conference. When I email with you, you're like, typically I get some reply that you're in some other country, you know, doing some justice work. So how has spiritual fatigue felt for you just throughout these last, you know, 8-9 years?
It's felt right now is where it's felt.
I'm
42, and I have 4 kids, and I actually was on a trip with you, Noah, when I picked up some parasites that have forever changed my life, and so I've got some serious, down in Haiti, so serious health issues kind of stemming from being down there after the earthquake with World Relief. So I feel like I've got plenty of things that equal my thorn in the flesh. And I just have chosen to take them that way, that I'm not the guy I used to be with a ton of energy. I'm not the guy I used to be that could do anything I wanted to. God's kind of slowed me down. And at the same time, it seems to match with being able to have a different kind of leadership with books and being able to speak at conferences. So, yeah, I really treat the fatigue I have now as something God has allowed in my life that reminds me, you know, that I am weak and that I have to find my strength in Him and that I can't do it all on my own strength. So my spiritual fatigue feels like, you know, I tell people these days 42 is the new 80. You know, I don't know, I feel like an old man. So that's my spiritual fatigue. But I think, to be honest with you, man, I think it's a really big topic these days, because I think people's heads are spinning, like you said, with the amount of noise. I mean, just trying to keep up with what's in your Facebook feed is dizzying. Trying to save the world is overwhelming. And it seems like every Christian feels this burden to have some cause out there and to be at the forefront of that cause. And it just wears you out over time. And it comes from this strange place of defining ourselves by our works. And defining ourselves by how other people are able to see us doing these works. And I think it's just a thing that we've got to break somehow, a cycle that we've got to break. So I talk a lot about that towards the end of The Grand Paradox, just how to deal with all the information and the noise, like you said, how to maybe think a little bit about this spiritual fatigue and how to slow down and become a person again, become human again.
Mm-hmm. Dude, there's something so deep about that. I think of when we both started our churches at about the same time, 8-9 years ago, there was like a church planting craze that was just starting. And it was this, you know, this, I don't know the statistics offhand, but churches are being just planted and planted and planted. And still that craze is sort of still going on, where for you and I, very different journeys, but looking back over about the same period of time, I think we see how fast paced ministry has been as church planters.
Sure,
and
sure.
I'm encouraged by some of the sort of damage control that I've seen. You know, you see some books coming out that have to do more with slowing down, right, and these sorts of things. But I'm also discouraged, to be honest with you, to still see some of that same, I think of it like puppy mill church planting, like just the more breeding we can do, the better. And it doesn't matter what care is really being taken for these planters. But I know for me, man, most of my 9 years of planting, it really came from a point of works. Now, I never set out for that, but I said I just wanted to help the kingdom and I wanted to see Jesus do this amazing work. But meanwhile, I felt like a failure as a Christian whenever these amazing works weren't happening. And then I realized that's the opposite of the gospel, right? The opposite of the gospel is that I'm defining myself by my works, and I feel like a failure if I'm not performing good enough. And so, I'm just really glad you hit on that in The Grand Paradox and that you share it yourself, because that's what I want to do with this podcast, is try to show people like you and I, you know, planters, you don't have to be the next whoever, fill in the blank, that we try to be to try to really, I think, gain God's approval based on.
Well, the thing young guys don't know, and I didn't know it at the time, but I think it'd be true of you, it'd be true of me, it'd be true of probably anyone that's found some success in church planting, is that all the biggest things weren't ideas that I had, and they certainly didn't come from copying other people. And so it was out of my faith walk and kind of commitment to try to breathe life into a community, or at least shepherd a community that God was kind of bringing about. It was out of that faith that the best ideas came, or even things out of left field that had nothing to do with me came along. And so it's really interesting when you start, you think it's all about copying or emulating, which is really a comparison game. And the reality is every church is unique, just like every family is unique. And every church, I think, has a will, God's will for that church, to be its best self. And that really comes, yeah, not by being in the game and trying to compete with it, but really following the Lord and submitting to kind of the things he'll bring just in the course of every day. And yeah, and I think it's getting harder too. So I would look at it, there was a definite church plant boom. And I think a lot of guys were planting because it was the thing to do. But there's in the Northwest here, a 75 to 90% failure rate. And marriages of guys were blown up because church planters don't quit easy. And their marriages or families take the hit before they'll shut the thing down. I think now it's a little less sexy to plant a church, a little bit harder. And so I think that that's helping a little. It's a little ways towards maybe filtering out and really the guys that are called, you know, are the ones that are continuing on in that path. But so much has changed in the last decade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it cut out just a second. You said 75% failure rate. Is that what you said?
Some cities, 75 to 90% within 5 years.
Right.
You know, they'll get up to 30 or 40, hang out there for a while with a bivocational pastor, and he's killing himself trying to, you know, put food on the table and get the church going, and then eventually pull the plug on it. Yeah.
So this will be my last like church planting sort of question, and we'll close up with some Justice Conference stuff. But what would you say to a church planter whose church has dissolved? I'm sure you know some. I know some. So somebody that sets out, they do this for Jesus, and they raise financial support, and they have all these people that they have to send prayer letters to, and you know they're reporting on these numbers. We have this many people come to Christ, and all these things, and like all of a sudden, this thing's not sustainable, or something did blow up in their life, and now the thing they've poured their identity in for the last 4, 5, 6 years is closed. It's out of business.
Yeah.
What kind of counsel do you give someone like that?
Well, there's one warning and one encouragement, right? So the first thing would be you had a position of leadership. So how are you going to steward that now that you've hit a rough patch? And so some church planters, when it goes bad, they bail on the local church.
Sure, right.
They're a bit embarrassed, or they don't have the personality. They're mavericks, so they don't have the personality to sit in at another local church now that theirs isn't working. And I would simply say, if you don't want to become a hypocrite, and if you want to steward the influence well that you had as you led your church, you have to be willing for a season to continue on with the local church and to be committed somewhere. Otherwise, it looks as if it was just about you. You know, it's hard because there's a lot of pride to get swallowed in that. That's the warning. The encouragement is this, from Joshua and Caleb to even on the negative with Samson. You see so many stories in the Bible where there's always a time to come back and find God's will for your life and to be successful at it. And so just because in your 20s or 30s, there's a bad experience, and as painful as that is, there's so much God can still do with a guy. And frankly, there might even be more he can do with someone because they've gone through
a tough
experience, they've gone through a failure, they can identify with that. And if they're willing to continue to trust God and to continue to believe, I think God can redeem that in such an amazing way. So I would want to encourage those guys and just say, hang in there, continue to dream. Don't identify yourself with failures or perceived failures. Rather, look at what God can still do with you and walk forward in obedience in that.
That's solid, man. Well, I want to wrap up with just a question or two about the Justice Conference and justice in general. You also wrote the book Pursuing Justice 2013 with Thomas Nelson as well, and founded the Justice Conference, which is coming up. I'm glad it's in Chicago this year. Midwestern boy myself, I will get to be there live and in person, so I'm excited for that. So June 5th and 6th. And talk quick before I get into my question about justice. Just obviously people can go to the website, give us the website, but tell us about the simulcast locations and just kind of what the mindset is behind that.
Yeah, it's just thejusticeconference.com, and there's going to be different cities that have kind of a one-day event in conjunction with the Saturday of the live conference, where there's local speakers, and then through simulcast, some of the some of the people that are on the platform at the Justice Conference in Chicago. And this is something that really was born out of a desire to talk about a theology of justice, that, you know, understanding of God should drive our love of others. And so bringing people together, hopefully the people on the right end of the theological spectrum, showing them that love and justice are central to the gospel. Hopefully the people on the left end of the spectrum or the liberal side of the spectrum, showing them that theology is really important to justice, that we can't just run off and do justice, that it's rooted in kind of strong theology, that people are made in the image of God. So really trying to pull these two things into the middle. And then also taking a lot of young people and giving them a framework so that they don't just get caught up with causes. I mean, certainly people that come to the conference learn about race or sex trafficking or whatever it might be, poverty issues. But we want people to realize that being just has just as much to do with how I treat my wife or how I respond to the person that cuts me off on the road as it does with what I'm doing about sex trafficking in Asia. That if I'm really going to understand biblical justice, it becomes my righteousness, my justice, and how I interact with all the different spheres of life. And so it's a real fun thing that I think really brings a robust conversation on justice to the American church.
Yeah. There's two ends of the spectrum on justice, I think, when it comes to paralysis. You know, you have the person, I think we've talked about a bit, they try to save the world. And I really love what you say in pursuing justice, and you come back to it in the grand paradox about how saving the world. And why don't you, instead of me putting the words in your mouth, talk about.
I always say that just because we can't fix the world doesn't mean we can't change it.
Yeah, that's right. Just because we can't fix the world doesn't mean we can't change it. And I love that because you look at the type of change Jesus brought, and he has all these paradoxical things like, if you have faith like a mustard seed, you can move a mountain. Well, that's a paradox. You know, he has all these things like the last will be first. And so the change, and I think that's where I as a church planter struggled in my early years, was change had to be big. It had to be macro, right? And that's fixing the world. And there's so much subconscious selfishness and ego and insecurity in that, I think, for us. I know at least for me, it was like I'm going to be God. Like, God needs me. He can't do the job himself, so I'm going to save the world, right? And meanwhile, Jesus says, change the world. I've fixed the world. I finished the work on the cross to fix the world. So how does that help someone out of paralysis, I guess, when it comes to justice work?
Well, I think Eugene Cho, who's a buddy, pastor up in Seattle, wrote the foreword for The Grand Paradox. He also came out with a book not too long ago called Overrated. I think he does a phenomenal job of addressing all this, that there really is a desire to be heroic. And so one of the things I try to say is that we're not called to be heroes, we're called to be faithful. And so, you know, change happens as we influence people or society. If we're looking for the limelight and trying to aim right at it, we're either going to miss it and never get out of the starting blocks or damage people along the way. So in our effort to make it really about ourselves, we become just no different than the dictator in Congo, you know, or no different than the oppressor who, to their own ends, uses people.
Yeah.
And so it's a funny thing how we can become the very thing that we're working against. And the way to do that is to, I think, again, come back, realize we're a part of the problem as well as part of the solution. That it has to start in the closest circles within my life. It has to start with repentance and owning responsibility and really becoming a good leader and a good influencer. And then over time, that influence, whether it's Gandhi or Mother Teresa or whoever it is, that influence will spread and I'll be able to make a positive impact, but it has to start from the right place. So yeah, Eugene Cho's book is a great place to start that way.
That's super helpful. I'll put a link to that. Because I hate to see people paralyzed. I want to see people doing justice work. I don't want to see them give up on it because it seems overwhelming. But when we do it, because I've been there, I don't want to see us doing it for the wrong reasons and just making things worse, you know, inside of us. So
paralysis. I mean, it's not a word that gets brought up with me often, or even a question that gets brought up often. But I think you're hitting on something there. And when you look at paralysis. in the New Testament. It comes from a couple different places. So you see paralysis in the spiritual elite, the Pharisees and all that, because they're not on Jesus' team. So they're kind of stuck, and they're like, Jesus has got this movement going, but we're not on his team. And I think there's a lot of people that are stuck that way too. It's like, man, I'd have to give up power or privilege.
Yeah.
I'd have to give up money or ease or comfort to really get on board with what Jesus is doing. I don't know that I want to do that. So that's a form of paralysis. You got Jesus' disciples who thought it was going to be all one way of success.
Right.
It was going to be easy. It's going to be glory. They were going to be the heroes sitting at the left and the right. And then when Jesus dies, they go back to fishing, and they're stuck. They're scared. They're paralyzed.
Yeah.
They're hiding in upper rooms. And so I think there's a lot of different ways, but they all come back to the person and work of Jesus Christ, that he's not here to facilitate our dream for our life, whether we're on another team or whether we have the wrong ideas of Jesus' will. It really comes to, are we going to submit and get on board with what his plan is for the world, not his plan for us? I say in the grand paradox that we act as if God has 7 billion different wills,
yeah,
you know,
right.
One for every person,
exactly.
Rather than one will big enough, one plan big enough to include 7 billion people. And so I think when we get out of this individualistic kind of thinking and are really willing to submit to the personal work of Christ, his plan that is working out within this world, and we're going to serve that as a part of the body who's submitted to the head of the body, the head of the church, then I think we begin to go, you know what, there's life flowing through me. There's stuff I can do. I know how to do this. It's not too much for me, or, you know, it seems to be working, or I don't know. It aligns everything. So I think there's a lot we have to do, remedial work, to go back and get rid of bad theology, because bad theology on Sunday leads to theological problems on Monday. So when most people are sitting there going, man, I got doubts, I got fears, it doesn't seem to be working, God's not answering my prayers, they're experiencing theological problems, and I think a lot of that traces back to bad theology at the outset.
Good, man. Man, you've been super generous with your time, and I just want to say I really appreciate it. I just have one final question just a question that I want to get real practically for you,
sure.
Kind of back to the pastor question. What advice would you give to churchgoers on how to treat their pastors? So how should a churchgoer support their pastor, pray for them? I think that's a gift that we can give to anybody listening to this.
Sure. It's an interesting thing where in the American Evangelical Church, we sit in judgment on our pastors. So we're critics, and they're the ones that we're scrutinizing.
Good.
I think that in Scripture, you see this fascinating thing with children and parents. In the Ten Commandments, it says, honor your father and your mother. And if you do, you know, you will have this kind of good life. God will take care of you. And it's the only one of the Ten Commandments that comes with that promise that if you do it, things will go well with you. And I think the reason that promise is given is God is saying, I want you to honor your father and your mother regardless of whether they deserve it. That if you do this in faith, it's going to go well for you, not because your mom and dad are so great that it's going to naturally go well for you. But if you honor them in faith, it'll go well for you because I'll bless you. So even if they don't deserve it, you honor them, I'll take care of you. Even if it's hard, you honor them, I'll take care of you. Even if you don't want to, you honor them and I'll take care of you. I think that pastors, how you treat pastors is very much the same way. We get caught up in this whether they deserve it or not thing. Whether they deserve it or not because of their gifts or their talents, whether they deserve it or not because of how we perceive their motives, whether they deserve it or not, who knows, right? And I think that churchgoers, if they can come back to looking at it and saying, in the New Testament, we're commanded to honor those who work hard amongst us, especially those who teach and preach, that we're supposed to respect our elders, that we're supposed to submit to them. I think it's a lot like children honor your father and your mother, honor your parents. So I would say to churchgoers, make it a faith thing. Treat them well whether they deserve it or not, because in faith, if you do what God has commanded in the New Testament, He'll take care of you. It's a better place to be honoring those people than it is to be trying to parse out whether they deserve your honor or not.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's where I would start.
And by treat them well, just for the record, you don't mean buy them a new car, you know, on Pastor Appreciation Day. Is that, I think,
like those
right?
guys that have, like those guys that have the gold toilet seats and things like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, well, I have one of those. My church comes on this year. Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I don't, I think it means I pay them well so that they can live on that. That now and then, if you have a way to honor them, you do it. Surprise them with something cool. But the biggest thing, I think, is just simply treat them the way you would want to be treated yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, the golden rule is a good place to start when we're talking about how to treat pastors. You know, treat your pastor the way you would want him to treat you if you were the pastor.
Yeah, I think that's super good, super helpful. And that's where the criticism and scrutinizing comes in, rather than just putting yourself in their shoes and saying, man, that's actually a pretty tough job. Like, what decision would I have made during that, you know? So, and I think to me, that's where friendships are built too. You know, I want
sure.
friends in my church, like people that have my back, knowing that I'm not perfect, but just treating me like a person, you know, just saying, hey man, I know you're not perfect, and that's, I'm going to love you and support you, you know, through these difficult things.
I'm going to see the good instead of dwelling on the bad. Yeah,
that's great, man. Well, hey, where are the best places to find you online? People want to keep up with what you're up to.
Sure. My blog is kenweitsma.com. My last name is Dutch. It's W-Y-T-S-M-A, so kenweitsma.com.
Cool.
You can find study materials for the book there. There's parent resources that go along with the book there. Best place to buy the book is on Amazon. And I go by KJ Weitzma on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and would love to be in connection with anyone listening to this. It's kind of focused on the same things. So,
hey, what is Ask Questions TV? Is that's your website too, isn't it?
Yeah, AskQuestions.tv is just a collection of short answer videos to almost any question you can imagine.
Cool.
That over the last 6 years have kind of come from a whole lot of different places, guest speakers, people at Antioch, people that have spoken at the Justice Conference, and there's a search feature there. So you can basically find a 3 to 7 minute video on almost any question that you have, which is kind of cool.
Solid, man. Hey, thanks again, Ken. I really appreciate it, and I really am looking forward to coming and hang out in Chicago in June. And thanks for just all you're doing for the kingdom and the great wisdom today.
Thanks for having me, man.
I encourage you to pick up a copy of Ken's books, Pursuing Justice and the Grand Paradox, and also check out the Justice Conference and consider attending at thejusticeconference.com. Really excited about next episode of the Behind the Curtain podcast. We'll be interviewing Ted Kluck for our next episode. Ted is the award-winning author of 15 books, including Why We're Not Emergent and Why We Love the Church, which he co-authored with Kevin DeYoung. He's also done biographies of athletes Jeremy Lin and Robert Griffin III. What we're going to be focusing on, more specifically, are two of his newest books, Finding God in the Dark and Household Gods. And these are two books that really go under the surface, behind the curtain, if you will, of what it's like to follow Christ. And Ted, being a ministry leader, as an author that he is, he really shows vulnerability and transparency in these books, and they're books that I really gravitated to. In our interview with Ted, we'll talk about this thing called Christian celebrityism and what I like to call, quote, how to publish a book without losing your soul, unquote. For me personally, I'm trying to get a book published. I've been working on it for several years now. And it is easy to lose your soul, so to speak, in the world of Christian publishing. So Ted's had several ups and downs in that area. He writes about those things in Household Gods as well as Finding God in the Dark. And so we're going to ask him about those things and talk to him about it. It's going to be a good interview. You're not going to want to miss it. Thanks so much for tuning in to episode 1 of Behind the Curtain. If you like the content and the feel of this podcast episode, I encourage you to check out at acrossroads.net for many blog posts about raw authentic topics of what it looks like to navigate life and God in an uncertain world. We'll sign off for now. Episode 1 in the books. See you next time at the crossroads and behind the curtain.